Hey everyone, this is Elaine and you're listening to Cha Tea Circle. I visited David Wu, who works as a counselor and mentor at Nanum, a faith-based addiction treatment center in Koreatown, Los Angeles, on the eve of the Dragon Lunar Year. I first met David online in May 2021 during a Zoom panel hosted by the Young Buddhist Editorial. In today's episode, you'll hear about David's work with his organization, Burning Pride, his own journey with Buddhism and addiction recovery, as well as the need to diversify the kinds of Asian American stories in the media. In other words, moving beyond the fancy Asian, jungle Asian binary that comedian and actress Ali Wong has talked about.
Thank you for having me. It's so great to see you again, and I'm just glad to be here and glad to have this conversation with you. When's the last time we saw each other? It was almost a year now, right?
Yeah, it was at the conference where you presented a paper. I have the title right here, The Noble Truths of Asian American Addiction and Recovery. And you were workshopping. It was a great reception. I wonder if you could summarize really quickly the idea behind that paper.
Sure. Maybe firstly, there's this traditional approach to academics being kind of third person, outside looking in approach, and kind of borrowing from critical race theory. There's this idea of the epistemologies of people of color, or looking at it from an emic first person. So in that view, if I'm studying Asian American addiction and how Buddhism can offer a path to recovery, well, I could just maybe also share my own story as someone that's Asian American, that is an addict in recovery, and is also Buddhist. So looking how those three come together in my own life and in the lives of those that are around me.
Because you touched on your own story, I wonder if you would tell your story in a way you feel comfortable.
Sure. Yeah, I grew up in the Los Angeles area of Southern California. And a lot of that was growing up in Asian American enclaves, from Garden Grove to Westminster to San Gabriel Valley, little parts of Chinatown here and there. And it was a complicated upbringing. I grew up in a converted Christian household. My dad was the first to convert in my family. His encounter with Christianity was during the Korean War. And my grandfather was abducted, never to be seen again by North Koreans. And that left my grandmother with many children to look after, including my father. And there were missionaries, there were Christian missionaries that were offering education and food. And that's how my father encountered Christianity and eventually became Christian. My grandma converted as well, or became Christian as well. My grandmother raised me, typical Asian thing, dad's always working. And as I look back and as I've been able to reflect, yes, she was Christian, but I would say, yes, she was also Buddhist and Confucianist and Taoist. It was Christian, but it was also kind of multi-faith. Definitely multicultural. And if we were to fast forward, it's this eventual discovery that major parts of what I struggled with, it was not just me. It was for others like me as well. There's this kind of like identifiable aspect to it. So Thich Nhat Hanh talks about how the enlightenment occurs when the wave realizes it's the ocean. I would primarily identify as, you know, being Asian American and an addict in recovery, right? Like this is the most kind of prominent standout things. The main kind of challenge I had growing up was around being different in a variety of ways. And the most prominent difference is that I'm Korean American, I'm Asian American. And then there's a difference between those two, right? Similarities and differences. Growing up around different races, black, brown, and white, and then struggling to feel at home. A sort of out for me was getting jumped into a gang when I was 13. And that provided a sort of sense of home. And it was a way to express what was growing into a certain furious anger. And in certain instances of violence, it felt like a way to take back power, and being perpetually disempowered. I can reflect on it now with a different understanding. Also being Asian American, it was regardless of how I was living my life, getting kicked out of school or using drugs at an early age. It was a mandatory thing to study and do well enough. But maybe the divide for myself as an Asian American started to happen around high school.
Mm-hmm.
Comedian Ali Wong talks about the difference between fancy Asians and jumbo Asians. The way I would maybe say that played out in my own life was the difference between the honors Asians and then the like regular class Asians.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely wasn't in honor classes. But all the things that I suffered from, it was just kind of growing in intensity and just trying to manage that as best I can. But still on weekends, still hanging out with homies.
Mm-hmm.
It's like one foot in, one foot out. And there's this psychologist, he has this saying, he says, it's hard to get enough of what almost works. And I think the way I was living, it sort of worked. It wasn't yet totally unmanageable. And when I was about 19, a really close friend of mine, his name's Michael, we nicknamed him Milk Boy because he was always a bit smaller than everyone else. So he needed milk to grow. So that was his like hood name. His name was Milk Boy. We were from the same gang. When we were about 20, we were coming back from a party in Reseda. And he got into a car accident and then was hit by a semi truck as he was trying to cross the freeway, and then he died. I still try to visit him as much as I can. But maybe that was the first kind of major moment where something is happening in the Asian American community that was mostly unseen, not considered, and not talked about, really. I eventually got clean at the age of 35, and this was as a result of me, for the third time, trying to commit suicide myself. I mentioned this thing around suicide because that's, to me, something also really indicative and prominent for Asian Americans, Asians and Asian Americans. For myself, the getting clean and then introduction to recovery was in a 12-step fellowship. NARUM is a residential rehab organization, church, community in Koreatown, Los Angeles, and houses about 40 to 50 residents. It's Christian-based, and they have regular services.
And how long have you been a part of the organization?
I've been part of the NARUM family for about 9 years now. And before I even came to recovery, my dad had mentioned it, like, hey, maybe it'd be good for you to go and check into to NARUM. But at the time, just the idea of this place, it was just not something at all I was interested in. So I'd been to other traditional, you know, American rehabs. And then I got clean, and it was such a rare thing to see an Asian American. There was a fellow that was like, hey, I have a panel. Would you come participate? And it's here. All right. It ended up being NARUM. And then as it turns out, my dad was roommates with one of the founding pastors when she was in college.
Oh, wow.
Back in the late 60s, 70s. So just this whole kind of, you know, the creator finds a way. You know, it's just to make these things happen. So we started this Sunday meeting, and it was just two of us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the number doesn't really matter, but point being is, you know, now there's not a seat empty because we've grown over the years. Mm-hmm. And then for us as Asian American seeking recovery, yes, this is a Christian faith-based organization, but doesn't mean that it's only for Christians. But I mean, if we were to kind of look at that, right, there's a particular verse that says, for whosoever does unto the least of these, my brethren, you do unto me.
Mm.
And so there's this kind of core message that we're called to serve those that are the least seen, the most marginalized. And I think as an Asian American, this is a space, not just this NARUM, not just this meeting, but Burning Pride, it's for those that maybe
feel the least seen and the most marginalized.
Because what manifests when we experience that, that's when addiction, self-harm, or whatever it is, manifests. And I remember one of my first meetings, it was a round robin format.
Mm.
So there's maybe about 50 folks in there, mostly what we would call newcomers, new to recovery, myself also being a newcomer. And for myself in this kind of first encounter to this new world and new fellowship, It was, in many ways, just an extremely uncomfortable experience. So there's about 50 folks. It's in a dark room. Everybody gets about a minute to share whatever's going on. Mm-hmm. Right? And I'm the only Asian person there. And then I'm also, incidentally, seated towards the end. You know, someone could have, like, stripped me naked and I'd feel just the same amount of uncomfortable in this situation. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sitting there, I'm listening to people share. And there are white folk talking about just extremely private things about their addiction and struggles to recover.
Yeah.
And I just was sitting there thinking, this is so against everything I was raised. And
it's just
this idea of openly talking about what I'm going through was so extremely foreign. And I just couldn't believe that this is something that I need to participate in. But then eventually we were able to find each other and get into a sponsorship relationship. Mm-hmm. And with that man, it was quite intimate. And he's someone that I still talk to today. And he's a near and dear person in my life, right? And I think that's kind of the point of recovery. And that's the point of what I'm now trying to do with Burning Pride is, I think as Asian Americans, we're still like this podcast and this amazing work you're doing, Elaine. It's like we're called to sort of pioneer these spaces that we didn't have for ourselves, right? And that's a burden, but that's also an honor to do so. It's so hard to find cultural spaces for Asian Americans in recovery. So that's the point of what we're trying to do with Burning Pride.
Can you share with folks what Burning Pride is exactly? And where you are in the process of developing Burning Pride?
So we're Asian American and BIPOC Buddhist Fellowship. We host regular group meditation and recovery-oriented meetings in Chinatown, Los Angeles, similar to how 12 Steps function or other recovery fellowships function. A major kind of discovery in my own journey in 12 Steps as it relates to just kind of being able to practice a Buddhist path to recovery, the principle understanding that these aren't self-help processes. We cannot recover alone.
The communal aspects of recovery.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe we haven't touched on this theme yet, but if you could share a little bit where Buddhism fit in for you in this whole journey and what Buddhist principles that you're drawing from for Burning Pride or how it helped you in your own process.
There's this podcast. There's this idea that meditation has like to become 10% happier.
Yeah.
But then for myself, in my recovery, it was to become maybe 10% less miserable.
Yeah.
Right? Before I became a 12-step member, I kept hearing about mindfulness, this beneficial practice. And then also there was I think, kind of burgeoning research around what they call mindfulness-based relapse prevention. I remember thinking, wow, this sounds a lot like Buddhism, right? But then there is so much mention about mindfulness,
right?
Like very rarely, if ever, I was like, oh, this is Buddhism, right? So it's just like this repackaging of something. But then again, though, the difference.
Minus all the ethics in Asian people.
Exactly, right? Now it's been repackaged to fit into, to conform into this individualistic self-help practice, right? It becomes a shell of what it really is.
Yeah.
Yeah. My first encounter with meditation was when I was in martial arts growing up, taking karate or whatever it was at the time. And then qigong, different encounters with training or traditions. So in my own recovery, when I was, I had this, what we call post-acute withdrawal. It was just impossible. My brain felt like it was just Swiss cheese. It was impossible to focus. My whole life was such a struggle. Just like menial activities were so extremely challenging, right? That's when I began to take meditation as this kind of daily regimented or prescriptive practice. And sure enough, it worked. It was a doorway to more, right?
Yeah.
So with Burning Pride, it's not just myself, it's others. okay, this is what worked for us, and we only keep what we have by giving it away.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the mission of the fellowship now is to share what we've been so freely given, as mm-hmm. the saying goes. Of course, this can maybe go into the Mahayana practice of Bodhisattvayana, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is the way to awakening.
Yeah.
This is the point.
I know that you made this documentary film called Get Jumped In.
Mm-hmm.
And I myself am a screenwriter and filmmaker. I love the arts. I loved your documentary. And it was about your friend Chester Chang, who died mm-hmm. suddenly due to gang violence. And I was wondering if you could share the process of making the film and your intentions for the whole project.
First up, thank you for watching. Here's the thing, right? It's like, even talking about gangbanging or gang involvement, it's a bit tricky because we went to certain places and did certain things. And was he gang involved? It's a bit tricky to say. In any case, Chester was murdered. And I also knew Chester because we went to college together. And maybe the most challenging thing was getting gang members that I knew that were Asian to appear on camera and mm-hmm. talk about things.
Yeah.
So this goes back to even my encounter with, or, you know, my initial encounter with 12 Steps and mm-hmm. being at that meeting. It's like, we tend not to be, talk about what's going on, which is interesting because it's changed so much, especially in today's, like, the tendency to just peacock in social media culture mm-hmm. now. So, you know, I have a good amount of experience working in Black and brown gang reentry and recovery spaces. And for Asian Americans, that's really lacking. And there's wonderful efforts today. But so back then when I was trying to make this documentary, it was just near impossible. And then another challenge was that I've still encountered to this day with the research I'm doing now is why Asian American? Why does that even matter? You know, and I remember I was talking to Chen Zinghan about this. And yeah, she so cleverly and poignantly points out, just even asking that question is the answer. There are so many things around his murder in my own life that remained unprocessed and I was struggling with. And speaking of addiction, you know, I was under the influence for a majority of making of that film.
Mm-hmm.
I did my best, but, you know, that's... I got into this motorcycle accident during the making of that film. My grandmother, who I mentioned, she was 97. And she was the matriarch. She was the heart of our entire family. And
mm-hmm.
this experience of moving to Southern California. And she was dying. And my sort of solution at the time of the challenges of getting around Los Angeles was to zip around on a motorcycle,
mm-hmm.
trying to visit my grandmother when she was in the hospital. In a car, it would take maybe an hour and a half, but mm-hmm. on a motorcycle, I could get there in 30 minutes. I would commute to school like that too. And one day I was riding down La Brea, splitting lanes, and then this truck, it's real hard to, when there's traffic, it's real hard to kind of make these unprotected left turns.
Yeah.
So he made a left turn and then slammed into me.
Yeah.
And then knife flew into this like house or yard or street. Yeah. So I messed up my shoulder and then it required surgery, but
I'm making
this, there's too much going on. And I remember too, so our dear grandmother was dying. So I remember I shared none of this about
with
what
her.
Happened with my
with,
definitely not her, but my whole family.
Yeah,
I didn't
yeah.
tell anyone in my family.
Yeah,
it was just like just this sixth sense of it should be about her, not me.
Right, right.
This like over self-effacement and
yeah.
inability to kind of acknowledge, you know,
your own suffering.
Exactly.
Yeah.
yeah, yeah. And plus, at the time, quote unquote, pain management was really a thing.
Yeah.
So getting opiates was just significantly easier than, for instance, mm-hmm. it is today. So it's a lot cheaper to use heroin, and that's how it became heroin.
Wow.
And then my grandma passed, mm-hmm. and social scientist Tim Kasser talks about in America this sort of these junk values. Mm-hmm. And then how do we look at these junk values through an Asian American lens, right? So this idea of success. It's like, if we can just get to this, if we can become successful, then mm-hmm. that everything our parents sacrificed for, it was worth it, right? Yeah. Whether getting into a really great school and graduating, yeah. getting a great job, making yeah. money. And then for me, it was like, oh, I need to make this film and then continue as a filmmaker. Mm.
That was your path to become a fancy Asian.
Yeah, there you go. To like, yeah, break through the doors, right? And like, hey, I'm here.
Yeah. Made it.
yeah, exactly. But there's also the struggle. It was... Yeah, it sounds really kind of condemning, but you know, what's phrased as these junk values. But yeah, there's that, right? There are things that need to be talked about as an Asian American and things that we went through.
Yeah.
And that's another thing, right, that we were just kind of mentioning earlier is that it took a while to kind of hear and understand that there's a difference. Yeah, ethnically, I'm Korean American, but mm-hmm. racially, I'm Asian American. Mm-hmm. And that's the difference there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then so working in or growing up with and working with Black and brown folk, yeah, I'm not Chinese and I'm not Chino. Mm-hmm. And like having to over and over, you know, that'd be just like this thing, right?
People would misidentify you.
Just over and over again, right? And then it's like, why does that matter?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we can even pull from 12 steps, right? So... there's also this tradition, and there's a third tradition where it says, in the context of whatever fellowship we're in, we're just that. For instance, if it's a fellowship around addiction, there's this tradition that protects, the third tradition that protects and says, when I come to these meetings and these spaces, I'm just an addict seeking recovery.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an Asian addict or whatever it is, or mm-hmm. white addict
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
or a Black addict. And what's the purpose of that? Well, it's to say that, hey, you know, maybe there's an obvious perceivable difference about me,
mm-hmm.
but please recognize me as someone just like you first. And mm-hmm. then from there, we can kind of move forward and get into like deeper waters, right?
Yeah.
So if I'm seen, and why is that so important? Well, it's like, it's not only are we kind of first seen as different, as perhaps a foreigner.
Right.
And then we're also on top of that misidentified.
Right.
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 And then as someone that's Asian American and as we're kind of trying to, you know, share these stories, it's like for myself and with Burning Pride, it's like, I don't think it's a fair expectation for other races to recognize us as what specific ethnicity we are. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But perhaps we can get to a place. Can we just be seen as Asian or Asian American?
Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm.
Can we be recognized? Yeah, we're racially different, and that is significant.
Yeah.
You know, so.
I guess what I'm hearing from you is, especially in a situation where you're going for a community based on a common goal, recovery, for instance.
Yeah.
It's a bit jolting to enter that community and be misidentified as something other than what you're there for first.
Exactly.
Because it immediately creates this distancing effect.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, yeah, I can see, you can see me as different, but can we meet as the same first? And then
right.
we can get into those deeper conversations.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. So there's this recovery saying when someone new comes into a space.
Yeah.
And this happens not just... in 12-step fellowships, but other spaces,
yeah.
you know, the saying is welcome home.
Right, right. right?
So yeah. it's like, hey, you know, to someone Asian American, it's like, yeah. hey, welcome home. By yeah. the way, where are you from? Right? Like, mm-hmm. you're not from where I'm from.
Yeah.
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 So it's like recognize someone, but then also recognizing
acknowledge
that,
their differences too,
yeah,
but in
yeah.
a way that's first welcoming them instead of saying, hey, you're not from here. You're
yeah.
not like me.
Right.
And then, yeah.
So, for instance, I can't tell you how many times it was just assumed that I live in Koreatown. And it's just, yeah. you know, just so odd to me. I've never lived in Koreatown.
Right.
Not because I'm avoiding it, just because I've just lived elsewhere. But, you know, that's what's been assumed. Like,
yeah.
to this day, there's,
yeah.
you know, folks assume that I... It's just so odd to me. Like, why is that a thing? You know, I don't... If there's someone's, like the other kind of identities in 12 steps. Like, so someone's Black, brown, or Jewish, like, I don't assume. If someone's Jewish, I don't immediately think they live off of Fairfax, right? Or whatever
right,
it is.
Right.
Or if someone's, you know, Black or Latinx, like, I don't assume that they're from a specific...
Exactly.
If someone's Latinx, I don't just assume they live in East Los Angeles, right?
Yeah.
But then, again, it's just, it's not so much just the stereotype, but it's like this lack of understanding.
There's that funny anecdote you shared with me. If you would share about the filming of your documentary and one of the pieces of advice that one of your professors gave you, I think.
I say. A lot of Asian American studies for myself, it felt like growing up, it felt really like it didn't feel so socially relevant at the time. What felt socially relevant was, in terms of race, was learning more and more about the Black experience racially, right?
I remember that was the same for me in my undergrad as well.
When I was making Get Jumped In, it's like I had to explain, with maybe limited understanding myself, why it's important to make a film about not just gangs, but Asian American gangs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then, yes, where there are Asian American gangs, and it's a significant issue. Not all faculty, but there was a number of them that just really, just, it was such a strange thing, the film I was trying to make. Yeah, they understood the tragedy of Chester being killed, but around the Asian American identity thing, it was not well understood. And so they would try to be helpful, some of them. And what you're mentioning is like trying to find locations when, I mean, it's a film, right?
Yeah.
It needs to be visual.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, where could we possibly go to shoot or film and cinematically portray Asian Americana?
Mm-hmm.
And then, so yeah, there was, I remember I was in, I think it was shooting dailies, and there was a professor during that class session. And then his suggestion was, there's up the street, there's a Panda Express. So he says, hey, wouldn't it be great if you go to this, maybe go to the Panda Express and ask them for permission to shoot, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, I just, that was something that I would hear.
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I'm chuckling out of, it, you know, there's a way that humor helps me too.
Of course, yeah. I mean, it's like so ridiculous. It's so funny now, right? But then at the time, I was
The time, you're speechless.
I was speechless. Yeah. And hey, I love eating at Panda Express.
Yeah, so.
Personally, it's like, that's true. Asian American food. Yeah.
What I really appreciated in the film was you reflected a perspective which I haven't heard much about, which is the suffering of Asian American men specifically. And if you could share what forms of specific suffering that Asian American men face, which I think could be different from Asian American women, for instance.
Yeah. This is tricky, right? We're going to go there.
Yeah.
But, we kind of talk about this.
We can play around and...
Yeah, so this is my first film, the first thing I ever shot, and this is like, you know, our first semester in film school.
Yeah.
It was about an Asian American man.
Mm-hmm.
That prowls the streets looking for white male, Asian female relationships. Yeah. And then he follows.
I like the premise of this film.
Yeah. And then he follows the Asian or the white man home.
Yeah.
And then in the film, and then he murders the Asian man. Right?
What?
Yeah.
The white man.
Yeah. Yeah. That was the first film I ever made. And yeah, there's a lot to like maybe unpack there. And
how was it received when.
Yeah, that's another thing. When I would submit some of these films to like these festivals, it would not get into any of the Asian American festivals.
Right.
But it would get into film festivals that, you know, are mostly organized by black folk.
Yeah.
So that was my first film. And I mean, that's kind of, you know, this was made, I don't know, 2005.
Mm-hmm. And that phenomena has only exploded even more since then.
Yeah, so I don't have the specific statistics, but there's a growing in popularity subreddit where it's
mm-hmm.
kind of, they, you know, point out these issues,
right? Yeah.
But then the point being is for myself, it's like this persistent otherizing and emasculating of Asian American males, right? That's been so fortunate. I remember I took this class with Professor Todd Boyd, and it was on Blaxploitation. And this film by Melvin Bad Peebles titled Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. I remember learning about this film, and basically it's like this revenge story. This black male character, main character, he just goes around the city and just exacts revenge. And he sleeps with a bunch of white women. It's like him kind of snapping back to like the subjugation he's experienced as a black male. So I think that my first film was sort of like kind of,
you know, an expression of that kind of rage through art.
Exactly. And then so this film, Melvin Mad Peebles, he makes this film, and I don't know, he spent like maybe $10,000 and it made $100,000. And that like 10 times profit is incredible. Like those are incredible margins for a film, right? So Hollywood seeing that there's money to be made. Like this became the start of the Blaxploitation era of film. And then also the reason that it made money, there's a legend around the film hit theaters. And then Huey Newton, one of the founders of the Black Panther Party, he sits and he watches the film and he leaves and then he comes back and fills the theater with Black Panthers, right? And then it becomes like this mandatory thing for
that
membership.
They all have to watch.
They have to watch this, right? And I think Asian American, like, we're waiting for that moment. And for me, Beef or whatever it is, like, it's definitely not it.
I did an interview this morning with Abbas Ratani, who helped found this platform called Mipsters, so Muslim hipsters. But it's like it's like a digital online platform, and it's amazing hearing how much like Muslim creatives come together for each other. I couldn't help but feel a little lost because I was like, I don't think I've ever had that with any community.
I hear you. Yeah.
But that's the sore point, I guess, for what I was just asking you about, too. The sometimes what is called Asian American, like I understand the way that you're trying to use it to valorize maybe a particular kind of story and identity that hasn't been reflected. But in the media and often what is celebrated as Asian American or promoted, I haven't personally felt very included in those spaces or very seen. And so I wonder, what kinds of stories would you hope to reflect more? What kinds of stories would you like to reflect more?
So at UST, I'm pursuing this doctorate, and we can fortunately put together what's termed a community-based project.
Right.
So the paper that was presented, it's going to be a book, and it's going to be our stories. This is not just my own, but again, the way of realizing is the ocean, right? Like something's going on here, and not, you know, it's not just me, others, and these stories, they deserve, just like any other story, to be shared.
Yeah.
The first time I'll say presenting this, the paper.
Was it
The Noble Truths of Addiction, which will just, this.
At a party.
Yeah. So it was the experience for myself, right? And it's not necessarily a call out. Maybe in the spirit of a call in. Like, I remember, this is touching upon even what you were saying, right? It's like the average attendance for any other of the presentations.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a lot of people there. It was about like 30 or so folks per presentation.
Yeah.
But then for our part on Buddhism and addiction, for myself, Asian American addicts in recovery, there was about like five people, and most of them were like involved in the presentation.
Yeah.
It was just like the least attended out of all of them, right?
Yeah.
And look, these things aren't personal, but this just, it just brought up and reminded me of like when I was trying to make films about Asian American gangs. It's like just not really interested, right? There was a moment when Better Luck Tomorrow was made.
Yeah.
And it kind of broke into mainstream. But in even that, maybe it's changed, but there was no direct acknowledgement that this was the murder of Stuart Tay.
Yeah.
And then it was also from the perspective of someone that, you know, heard about it or grew up with mm-hmm. knowledge about that. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't mm-hmm. in this like first person account.
Right.
You know? And then so even growing up, looking for films to watch that kind of spoke to us as Asian Americans, mm-hmm. myself and my friends, it wasn't Asian American films, it was Asian films that we'd watch.
Yeah.
Right?
Same.
So for us, it was like a cultural phenomenon for us. This is like during the import scene during the 90s. Mm-hmm. We all knew quite intimately the Young and Dangerous film mm-hmm. series that came out of Hong Kong. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It was about a bunch of Asian gangsters,
yeah.
Right? Young Asian gangsters. Mm-hmm. We'd all watched it over and over again. And, you know, for me, there wasn't much in terms of like Asian American content.
Yeah.
And then so even today, it's like the pervasiveness of this whole minority thing. Mm-hmm. It's like not just how we're viewed, but then also, you know, I speak on my own experience as well, how we view ourselves. It's like still trying to be this good Asian, so to speak. Or, you know, you mentioned the fantasy Asian, but I would call it like this honor roll Asian, whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
And then...
And the forms of suffering depicted are the honor roll Asian forms
of
suffering.
Yeah, yeah. So I think maybe the primary barrier, if I could speak as somebody that's kind of also trying to tell these stories, is that the one significant barrier is that Asian Americans of the other prominent racial groups, our suffering is that we don't recognize that we're suffering.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be a big challenge. So these stories that, you know, with the film or even the research I'm doing now, just to say, hey, yeah, we're here too, and we'd like to take part.
How does the theme of home or not having a home fit into the book that you're writing or in the stories that you're reflecting? Are you seeing that come up in people's experiences or whatever you're recording?
Yeah, so I would, you know, just like one of our initial conversations, mm-hmm. you're maybe saying that it seemed like I have real deep roots in
LA.
In Los Angeles,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But, you know, I would say another marker of this Asian American experience is that, like, nowhere really felt like home, you know? So a real dear friend whose entire life has been dedicated to working with young gang members.
Mm-hmm.
And primarily in the Latinx community.
Yeah.
His ties to Boyle Heights.
Mm.
It's so special to witness and, you know, to be with him when we're just, you know, a lot of us kind of jokingly, but truthfully, we call him the unofficial, he's like the mayor of Boyle Heights. And that's such a special thing. But, you know, for myself, where's home? Like none of the neighborhoods I grew up in, it's like, have I really ever been back to?
Yeah, it's the same for me.
Yeah, and so many of my close friends as well.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the closest thing that I've seen amongst my friends' groups is San Gabriel Valley as this mm-hmm. like home mm-hmm. or this mm-hmm. hood, mm-hmm. right, that they identify with. But then this is also something we're talking about where maybe the closest thing was returning to Hawaii,
mm-hmm.
which just felt like this kind of the only place in the entire world where it's English speaking as the language, and then it's also a majority Asian American or mixed. It's not just the felt experience, but how we were perceived as this perpetual foreigner experience.
Mm-hmm.
And then so even in a lot of the Asian American spaces, it's like it's the ones that could effectively kind of deny their own real, like, you know, Asian Americanness are the ones that seem to do quite well.
Best.
And then therefore that's the status quo of Asian Americana. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, it doesn't represent me.
Yeah.
You know?
Do you feel that Buddhism has helped you find a home in any way?
Yeah. So with Burning Pride and hopefully what we're trying to build, it's not just in Buddhism, but it's just recovery mm-hmm. spaces as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like
mm-hmm.
needing these recovery spaces.
Yeah.
That, okay, for instance, it's invariably, if we're in this mixed race, usually what mixed race meeting or space looks like, it's just maybe one or two Asians and the rest, you know, there's other like prominent majority,
mm-hmm.
right? So in these other meetings, if in the sharing portion, if there's like even a pause in the speaking, that uncomfortable silence, it's like it needs to immediately be broken, right? And usually it's someone that's white that's like, oh, hey, you know, no one's talking, so I'll go first, right? But then like when we have our Asian American meetings, it's like we're much more comfortable with that silence and we'll just wait. We'll just wait and eventually someone will speak. Mm-hmm. But there's these longer pauses that seem more culturally appropriate. And yeah. That's just how our meetings go. That's another example. I mean, that's something specific, maybe culturally, that we need in order mm-hmm. to feel comfortable and be willing to participate. So a specific maybe recovery practice in 12-step recovery is get phone numbers and use them, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Meet other addicts in recovery, get their phone numbers and give them a call. Mm-hmm. And then for Asian Americans, it's like, I have dear friends that I'll receive chapter length emails, but to like, hey, just to get a random phone call, it's like impossible to do so. And I have so many friends where they're just so uncomfortable just like talking on the phone that it's become like memeified, this whole really discomfort with just one-on-one connection communication, right? Mm-hmm. I get it. Like I had that thing too. Mm-hmm. So again, like the specific effort of what we're trying to do is we do this because our lives depend on it. Mm-hmm. It's not something that it's like this self-help practice that I'm going to try on New Year's Day as this resolution, right?
Yeah.
It's like, no, we need to do these things because our lives depend on it. Mm-hmm. And then maybe we're kind of, you know, more willing to step into the discomfort of it all.
I guess what I hear from you, thinking back to what you were saying, these culturally specific places or practices, is it helped to have a space dedicated for Asian Americans because it allows, for instance, even in speaking, right, a shared understanding that there isn't the presumption that people jump in or more comfort with silence. Probably that comes from, you know, the home life or being with your parents or just having silences and other spaces, and it becomes a habit. Just like in with other people, they learn from their communities or families where they always have to fill the space, right?
Yeah.
But then there could be probably an uneven, I don't know, like if I would call it a power differential, or just it could come to inhibit someone else's participation in a space if those who end up being the most vocal or, you know, they take up all that space.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So exactly. So myself and others, mm-hmm. you know, so I'm also fortunate enough to mentor other Asian Americans seeking recovery. When we go to these spaces, we'll be accused of, why are you so quiet? Right. Mm-hmm. Like that comes up again and again.
Yeah.
And it's not just in recovery spaces. It'll just the experience of growing up Asian American, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily that we're quiet, we're just maybe different. Mm-hmm. And that difference, I think, you know, should be better understood.
Yeah. Right?
So
it's interesting what you're doing, because I feel like for myself, I've tried to purposely be more vocal because I don't see many people like myself vocal. And then it's almost like I get more frustrated because then I wish more people who are similar to me or look like would be more vocal, but then there's no, so I'm always trying to play at, or maybe it's because of the space I'm in or, you know, whatever it is in academia or other spaces where I'm like, I feel this, I need to push myself to say or be present. Otherwise I just disappear, right?
Yeah.
But then it's a very lonely endeavor because it's taxing. Also, if you're more introverted like me, it's taxing, but then there aren't others like you to back you up ever.
I hear you. And I think that's another part of the experience, is just living with and experiencing that loneliness.
Yeah.
And that's also, you know, like I would kind of frame in that lack of home, like not having this home, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. I remember the first time, you know, I think it was like my first breakup in high school, I remember trying to talk to my mom, which is an understandable thing. Like, you want to talk to your mom. And then I remember her just saying, oh, just do good in school. And not that I was blaming her, but it was just, it's like hurt on top of hurt, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So we have these experiences and it's like, am I tripping? Is it just me?
Right.
Or is it, there's something going on?
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe that's kind of what you're getting at.
I was wondering if you could also share upcoming projects, aspirations, anything you would like to address that hasn't been addressed or that you hope our broader community of listeners might address in their conversations afterwards.
Yeah, I believe it's Joseph Campbell. He has that quote, the great privilege of a lifetime is to become who you really are.
Mm-hmm.
I think this touches on, you were saying how you try to be more vocal because there is that stereotype or there's that cultural tendency. And I get that. Like, I kind of experienced that myself. But at the same time, it's like, is that who I, and I'm just answering for myself, right?
Yeah.
It's like, is that really who I am? And I've worked for a number of organizations where that is part of the culture. And in social media as well, it seems to be the case, right? The sort of like peacocking, as I call it.
Mm.
And that's just not me. Because of these various cultural significant traits, it's the main thing, of course, that we're hoping to do for Bernie Pride, to open its meetings to any Asian American that need a fellowship,
mm-hmm.
right,
mm-hmm.
of understanding and recovering folks. So that's really it. And then also for myself in my own practice, there's traditionally maybe heritage Asian Buddhist spaces here in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. or in the United States. And then there's a lot of white Buddhist spaces. And there's some BIPOC communities. And I know there's others making that effort, but it's like, hey, we need a home as well, a place where we can kind of be understood and understand.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I've been in spaces like in the Soto Zen tradition where it's like a sea of white people.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I'm the only Asian American. It's just a really uncomfortable experience. Yeah. And not that they're intentionally doing anything, but it's just clear that this is not for me. Right. I wouldn't be in this kind of space in any other area of my life. And then I've been in, you know, plenty heritage spaces where, you know, I have a number of tattoos and I look a certain way.
Yeah.
So I don't really fit that either. It's like this. It's like, where can we just go and just be ourselves? And that's good enough. That sums up the experience in Buddhism, in our practice of Buddhism. It's like this inherent Buddha nature. And then as it relates to Asian American, it doesn't matter what we've been able to achieve. At the very core of who we are, we've always been good enough. And we don't need all these other extras, right? And I think that's maybe the real kind of revelation that we seek, right? And that's the struggle. It's like, right, it's not just myself, you know, my folks saying, hey, we sacrifice so much, so make our name proud and do X, Y, and Z, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then things will be okay. You know, I've been in therapy a number of years, and a traditional Western, you know, therapist might say, oh, that's codependency.
Yeah.
But I call that just growing up Asian American, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not codependency, like wanting these parents, like wanting so much for their kids, right?
Yeah.
It's something else. And so, yeah, maybe our work isn't to see it to its completion.
Mm-hmm.
It's just to do our part as best we can. So, yeah, then that kind of circles back. It's like Buddhism for me, it's just, yeah, I mean, meditation has been a really important practice. I really appreciate all the attention that mindfulness has gotten, and then for myself is in being in recovery. But there's so much more that speaks to me as well, right? And I don't foresee that I'll ever be someone that's chanting the Lotus Sutra, but hearing the Heart Sutra in not just English, but in Korean, in Mandarin, or in Chinese and Japanese, it's really special to be able to hear that,
mm-hmm.
you know, and experience that. Because at the heart of it, it's this journey of being not just Buddhist, but Asian American Buddhist.
Thank you very much for sharing your story and your time. with us today. Thank you
Thank
kindly.
You.
It's
Thank
happy
you so much,
Lunar
Lane.
New Year, everyone.
Yes.